Okay, I'll read from Ezra chapter 7, verse 11. And we're reading now the copy of the letter that Artaxerxes gave to Ezra when he began his journey to Jerusalem. Now, this is the copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave unto Ezra, the priest, the scribe, even a scribe of the words of the commandments of the Lord and of his statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace, and at such a time, I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and of his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee. For as much as thou art sent of the king and of his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of thy God, which is in thine hand, and to carry the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered unto the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem, and all the silver and gold that thou canst find in all the province of Babylon, with the freewill offering of the people and of the priests, offering willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem. Thou mayest buy speedily with this money bullocks, rams, lambs, with their meat offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them upon the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, that do after the will of your God. The vessels also that are given thee for the service of the house of thy God, those deliver thou before the God of Jerusalem. And whatsoever more shall be needful for the house of thy God, which thou shalt have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. And I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasurers which are beyond the river, that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily, unto 100 talents of silver, and to 100 measures of wheat, and to 100 baths of wine, and to 100 baths of oil and salt, without prescribing how much. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? Also we certify you that touching any of the priests and Levites, singers, porters, Nethinim, or ministers of this house of God, it shall not be lawful to impose toll, tribute, or custom upon them. And thou, Ezra, after the wisdom of thy God, that is to thine hand, set magistrates and judges, which may judge all the people that are beyond the river, all such as know the laws of thy God, and teach ye them that know them not. And whosoever will not do the law of thy God, and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be unto death, or to banishment, or to confiscation of goods, or to imprisonment. Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, which hath put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem, and hath extended mercy unto me before the king and his counsellors, and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened, as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me, and I gathered together out of Israel chief men to go up with me.
2 weeks ago, we finished the first part of this revival story, the return of the remnant from Babylon to Jerusalem under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. That covers the first six chapters. Last week, we started a second portion in chapter 7, the return of Ezra. We noted this event took place about 50 years or so after the events of chapter 6. Between these two chapters, we fit in the events of the book of Esther. And now chapter 7, we see the preparation of Ezra to return. And straight away, we are told the reason he was going to teach the law to this remnant. It wasn't enough that the remnant were gathering in the right place, on the right scriptural ground, you might say. They'd been brought back to build a temple and built it. But now we see what is needed to maintain a remnant in that place, in that character. And that is a teaching of the word of God. And chapter 7 deals with the preparation of Ezra for this service. We read the first 10 verses last time, and we saw two qualifications, if you like, for Ezra. First of all, in the first 5 verses, we see by birth, he was a priest. He could trace his genealogy right back to Aaron, the chief priest. It's no good us trying to serve God unless, if you like, we can trace our genealogy. We can trace our genealogy back to Christ, as it were. We can see we are, by new birth, qualified to serve. That's the work of God. Ezra had no choice in the matter as to who he was when he was born, his line of descent. It was entirely of God. But then in verse 6, we have the other side. Ezra was not only a priest by birth, but Ezra had dedicated himself to be a ready scribe in the law of Moses. He'd studied the word of God, and we concluded then in verse 10, perhaps one of the key verses, certainly the key verse in the second part of this book, Ezra had not only desired to teach these things, but he realized, first of all, he had to direct his heart. He had to be exercised as to seek out what it was, to understand it, to know it. That's the first thing. And then to do it, to live it out. And only then could he teach in Israel these statutes and ordinances. Now we come to verse 11. We might say the third preparation for this service was his faithfulness in his secular work. God doesn't choose men who are unfaithful to serve him. And as we go down this chapter and consider the words of the king, we will see that time and time again, at least 12 things that I can see, the king says, I trust Ezra with this. I'm giving Ezra the responsibility to do this because he's faithful. I know if I give this to him, he will do it. Many things, and we can consider these things, the faithfulness that Ezra displayed in his secular work. Now, with many men of God who were called, we are not told what they were doing when they were called. We can think of Elijah, for example. We don't know what he was doing, but we simply see Elijah standing before the king, pronouncing judgment. It will not rain until I give the word, as Jehovah says. But there are many men. I did try to make a list before the meeting. I came to about a dozen men whose activities, when they were called, we know. You can think of Moses, that he was faithfully tending his father-in-law's flock in Midian. David was faithful, looking after his flock. We can think of Peter and Andrew casting their nets when the Lord called them. James and John were mending their nets. All fishermen. Matthew was serving as a tax collector. We can think of a good number. The exception, I think, that proves the rule, I can only think of one man who was called while he was unfaithful in his service, and that was Saul, called to be king over Israel. He was searching for his father's asses that were entrusted to him, but he'd lost them. Well, that describes man in the flesh. But generally speaking, when God wants to use somebody for service, and if we want to be useful to God, we first have to be faithful in little things, in our secular work. And here, Ezra, the third qualification, very important. We have to be faithful in our service. He was faithful in his service to this Gentile king. He accepted his dominion over the people of Israel because of their failure. He served faithfully, and Artaxerxes was happy to give him all this responsibility. It's very important. So not only must we, first of all, I might say, be believers to serve God, and we have to have that desire to serve God, a desire to live out the truth before we teach it. We also have to be faithful in this third point, and perhaps in the last two verses of the chapter, we will see one last point before we get to the end of this section. He was a worshipper. Very important that we are worshippers. So these are, I would say, the four features we get in this chapter. The next chapter then, we still don't get Ezra serving. We have those with him. That's more lessons. But individually, we learn these four points concerning Ezra. And if we want to serve God, if we want to be of use to him, then the point before us tonight now is, are we faithful in that which God has given us to do in our, I might say, secular lives, not necessarily as we are out at work, but whatever responsibility we have at home, in the family, at work, or whatever, are we faithful? Or even, might say, in the local assembly, when did God call Barnabas and Saul? They were faithful in a little work, and God said, separate me these two. I've seen them, they're faithful, I have use for these two. So we might even say in our local assemblies, we need to be faithfully serving God, and then we make ourselves available. We are profitable to God. So this is, I think, the point we get from verse 11 on.
I suppose you could say that this letter was Ezra's letter of commendation, if you want to put it into a setting that we're used to in our gatherings. He could be commended, of course, not to an assembly, but to those who he would encounter in his service. It's remarkable that King Artaxerxes should write this letter, but it does show what you're saying, Andrew, that he had, we don't know exactly why, but we don't know the exact circumstances of his relationship with Ezra, but obviously he had some knowledge of Ezra and could commend him and commit to him a responsibility which he, as king, saw as very important. He obviously had some exercise to help the building of the house of God in Jerusalem. It had already been built, but to beautify it, he obviously saw that as important. And if he didn't do it, it might have consequences for his own kingdom. We read that in the verses that we considered at the beginning of the of our time together. So he felt that it was right for Ezra to go up. His relationship with God isn't clear from what he says, but he obviously reverenced God. He obviously saw God as someone who had authority over his own empire, and he saw Ezra as the person who, by his actions, would not only help the Jews in Jerusalem, but would be of service in relation to God in a way that also had consequences for his own empire. So I think that really supports what you're saying, that Ezra was somebody who had already proved himself faithful in the setting he was in when he was in Babylon. I suppose you could add another one to your list. I don't know if you mentioned him. I might have missed it, but Nehemiah was also in this situation later on, maybe just 15 years later. The king could send him, and it's evident that Nehemiah was someone who was held in respect by the same king. Actually, it's the same king in both cases. It makes you wonder who actually Artaxerxes was. Now, I think there's really good evidence for thinking he was the son of Ahasuerus, the man who, or the king who married Esther. And you can't help thinking that he had been influenced in his own heart and soul by the experiences that he had had as being part of the kingly family in Persia when King Ahasuerus, who would obviously be his father, married Esther, and then all the dealings that occurred with the Jews in Persia itself took place. But that's just a suggestion, because it can't be said dogmatically to be the case. But certainly the important point is that he had confidence in Ezra, because Ezra was a faithful man.
In the course of this letter, Artaxerxes acknowledged that Ezra's God was the God of the heavens, verse 12, the God of Israel, verse 14, the God of Jerusalem, verse 19. And he also acknowledged in verse 23 that he himself was responsible to such a God.
Yes.
Whose wrath was to be feared, in verse 23 again. So was he a believer? Well, we can't say for certain. What we can say, I think, is that Ezra set a very good testimony to God, so that Artaxerxes knew God.
Yeah.
He knew of God, and he was responsible to believe in this God. Now, whether he's a believer, we don't know. But Ezra's testimony, we can be assured, was very good. And where we live, where we work, do we give such a testimony? Is God known through us? I'm sure God was known, well, not only through Ezra, but probably through Esther and others, but we're looking at Ezra here. He gave such a testimony that the king acknowledged God in all these ways. Now, that's a challenge for me. How much do people around me know of God through me? Mm-hmm. It's something we all have to really ask ourselves. But Ezra is a very good example in this. And when we see what the king says, not necessarily about Ezra even, but about God, we can only assume that Ezra was a very faithful man, not only in his secular work, but he gave testimony in that work to the God whom he served.
In chapter 6, when Darius was speaking, he could say in verse 10, "And pray for the life of the king and of his sons." And I wonder if that had some bearing on Ahasuerus, that he realized that the God that was Ezra's God was in control.
Yes.
And very often you will hear politicians, and there's a disaster happen, that we will pray for them. Whether they do or not, that's their responsibility. But generally, men realize that there's a God somewhere. They might not know him personally, but very often they will pray or say they are going to pray to the God. And I just wondered whether this was something that was in the back of Ahasuerus's mind when he wrote this letter.
I think verse 23 would back up what you say, Rusty. One of the things later on that the king says down there is, "Whatever is commanded by the God of the heavens, let it be carefully done for the house of the God of the heavens. For why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons?" He knew that what the Israelites were, the remnant were doing there, was for the benefit of the king and his sons. It goes back to the words of Darius. He understood this is what they were doing there. And if he treated them well, God would bless them, him, for their sake. So I think the words of Darius would certainly have been known by Artaxerxes. He understood this was what they were, one of the things they were doing there was for the benefit of the king.
What I think is quite impressive about what Artaxerxes writes is that he says that, well, it depends a little on the translation you're reading, but in verse 12, he says, "Unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven." In the Authorized Version, it says, "Perfect peace, and at such a time." In the Derby translation, it says, "To Ezra, the priest, an accomplished scribe of the law of the God of the heavens." Whichever way you read it, he seemed to understand that Ezra was not simply a scribe, but a priest. And obviously, we know from the genealogy at the beginning of the chapter that you looked at last week, he was indeed descended from Aaron, so he was of the priestly family of Israel. A scribe, he gave attention to the law of God. In the story of Josiah the priest, one of the Josiah the king, the last king of Judah, that was a faithful king, there were two men. One was a scribe and one was the high priest. Shalom, I think the first one's called, the other one's called Hilkijah, who's actually mentioned in this genealogy of Ezra. But these two responsibilities of being a scribe and a priest, one who looked after the people, represented the people before God. Of course, unlike Hilkijah, Ezra couldn't have offered sacrifices because the temple had been destroyed beforehand, and he was still in had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and he was still in Babylon at the time he was sent, so he wasn't an offering priest in that sense anymore. But he combined both these roles, attention to the word of God and approach to God, in the sense he was still of the priestly family. So in the Derby translation, it says accomplished priest. So I get the impression that Artaxerxes had some knowledge of the way in which Ezra carried out his duties, which is just reinforcing what you said earlier, Andrew. But he did seem to know Ezra really quite well.
In verse 13, he gives the opportunity for any to go back with Ezra. Similar sort of freedom that was given to Zerubbabel and Joshua at the start. Cyrus gave this freedom, and now Artaxerxes gives a very similar invitation. Any who wants to go back, go back. And the next chapter will detail those who did. But before then, in verse 14, we get the reason why. Because verse 14 starts. So why is Artaxerxes given this command? Well, there's a reason. And we get that from verse 14 onwards. Why? Because here was a man who could be trusted. Here was a man who had the interests, not only of the remnant at heart, but of the king. Because the remnant were there for the good of the king, as well as for God. And we've in verse 14 onwards, there are many reasons given, many things entrusted to him, just as even Zerubbabel and Joshua were entrusted with things to take back. They could take back all the implements that were going to be used in the temple. They were entrusted, and when they got back, they had to account for them. And in a similar way, now we will learn all the things that were entrusted to this man Ezra.
He calls himself the King of Kings. Clearly, he was a great monarch and had great power. And we know this was the time of the Gentiles, and the people of God were under their rule. They could only do what they were allowed to do by permission of these great monarchs, as we've seen. But this letter does seem to be rather special, in as much as its whole character is one of benevolence to God's people and to Ezra in particular. And really, the king here almost takes the place of God, really, in the way that he blesses the people in a similar way to Ahasuerus in Esther, because the way that he gives all this provision, you know, if we were living in today and the governments of our day gave this kind of blessing to Christians, that would be a rather remarkable thing. And of course, we know that those who bless God's people, they are blessed. And of course, God's people are still his people, even though he doesn't acknowledge them as such at the moment. But the way that this whole chapter goes on and the details of it, and of course, in verse 14, we have "thou art sent of the king and of his seven counselors." And so the king really takes the position of sending Ezra to do this work in Jerusalem.
Yeah, you can't help thinking that, given what we've said, that the story of Esther occurs between chapter 6, between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of this book, that this king was conscious that at one point, and I'm not going to press the idea that his father was Ahasuerus, but at one point, Haman had deceived one of his predecessor kings into exterminating the Jewish people in Persia. Now he's exercised to actually use the resources of the royal house to support the Jews in Jerusalem, whereas the king that was tricked by Haman until Mordecai and Esther intervened through the mighty hand of God, he was also going to give Haman the resources to exterminate the Jews. So it's remarkable that God, the heart of the king is in the hands of God. God turns him. I'm not quoting the verse absolutely correctly, but we can see that God is moving this king to act in a way of that's going to lead to the blessing of the remnant in Jerusalem. In a way, perhaps even Artaxerxes himself is being exercised in his heart to do this, because he's conscious that before there had even been a way in which the royal house would have actually persecuted them, even unto death. God changes the scenes. He's behind the scenes, but he's able to change the scenes. And Ezra's own deportment and behaviour commended this to the king, I'm sure. And perhaps sometimes we don't realise that if we serve the Lord faithfully, he will often intervene in higher things over which he has control to bring blessing to his people. So it's good for us to respect those in government, because it's something that's been ordained of God for our blessing. And certainly Ezra is an example to us of someone who's done that.
In the book of Esther, Ahasuerus mused, "What shall be done for the man who the king delights to honour?" And yeah. That man was Mordecai.
Yeah.
Now, probably his son, I think you're right, Artaxerxes, was doing something similar. What is he going to do to this man, Ezra? He is going to honour him. He is going to give him a very great commendation. He's in this letter, when these people read it, they would have thought, wow, this man Ezra, he's very high in the opinion of this king.
Yes.
He was honoured, greatly honoured, because of his faithfulness. Well, that begs the question, what do people think of us?
Yeah.
They might not, they might not like us, but we're Christians, but we should act in a way, just as Ezra and Mordecai, we should act in a way that is commendable to all around. And if people are honest, they will have to say, well, these people are trustworthy. I can entrust them with these things. Mm. And the first thing we get in verse 14, he's going to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of God, which is in thy hand. I want to know what's going on there. Who shall I send? I know I'll send Ezra. He's a man I can trust. He will inquire. He will understand how the people are doing concerning the law of God. He's going to inquire for me. He's going to report it back then. I will get a true report from him. He's not going to lie to me. He's not going to deceive me. He's not going to hold anything back. If I send him with this task, he will perform it. And we can think of similar things. When Paul wanted to know what was going on in Thessalonica, he said, I'll send Timothy. There's a man I can trust. And Paul gave him a great commendation. He's just like me. He serves the Lord just as I do. I send him because I know he's going to give an honest report. And he came back and he did. And it caused Paul to write that letter. So trustworthy, this man Ezra, greatly honoured by the king. And the first reason was, he will give me an honest report. If I give him a task to do, if I ask him, inquire for me, what is going on, how they are faring, I know he's going to be going to give me a full and an honest answer. Well, are we fully honest? Are we open? If we are given a task, do we perform it faithfully? Well, Ezra did, and we need to do the same.
Yeah, we're going to find out in chapter 9 and chapter 10 that the remnant had a real problem. There had been unfaithfulness. And I don't know that the king would have known this, or even Ezra knew it. We can understand why Ezra would be sent to help the people, particularly in regard to the matter of the law, as you mentioned earlier on. But I think it was more from a positive point of view to help them do that and to strengthen them and lead them on to further service of God, not deal with the problem of the fact that they had taken foreign wives. But God knew that, and God knew the right man to deal with that problem. We're going to see, I'm sure, when we come to the chapters, that Ezra not only knew the law, but he knew how to deal with this problem. He's marked by all the attributes which help in situations like this, not least humility in the way he dealt with the matter. He identified with the people, despite the fact that he himself had not failed in the way they had failed. But Artaxerxes would have known nothing of this, but God is using him. And so it's right, quite remarkable, these words in verse 14, to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, according to the law of thy God, which is in thine hand. God is in control. God is using Artaxerxes and, of course, preeminently Ezra for a purpose which probably neither of them actually knew, because in verse 15, it's obvious that there's a sense that they need more resources, silver and gold, and the king and his counselors. This was a Gentile king, and his counselors would have probably been Gentiles. I can't see any reason for not thinking that. They had freely offered this unto the God of Israel. So they wanted to help the house of God in Jerusalem in a practical way. And they sent a worthy offering a worthy present for that purpose in verse 15, and facilitated even more being added to the silver and gold that they were offering in verse 16. All this was designed for the blessing and benefit of God's people in Jerusalem. But they could trust Ezra to do this because, obviously, as we're going to see, Ezra was faithful in regard to these treasures which he took with him. They could count on him to carry out the job of bringing all this wealth to Jerusalem. They could count on him to do it honestly and faithfully.
We really see evidence of the mercy of God upon his people at this time.
Yeah.
As you say, that, you know, even though after the 70 years had passed and some had gone back, and still there was not really a universal faithfulness on the part of the people, but God allows this tremendous blessing to be sent in Ezra's hand, and the blessing of the king to progress the work, even at this little time of reviving.
Mm.
So we see God's hand of blessing, even in weakness. It's marvellous the way that God works in this way.
Yeah, it is.
We can count on him today in the same way.
We might have expected the king to have said, inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of the Persians. You go there and make sure they are doing all that they should as good subjects of the Persian kings. But the king seems more interested in their spiritual health.
Mm.
Remarkable, considering this king was the Persian king. So see how they're doing according to the law of your God.
Mm.
Now, try to apply that. How often when I've met one of you and I've said, how are you? And all that's been in my mind is the physical.
Mm.
How are you doing physically? And not that I would want to wish ill health on anyone. It's good to inquire of physical health. But how often have I lacked that thought? I want to know how you're doing spiritually. When we say, how are you? Do we instantly think all they're asking about are my physical ailments? Really, we should be like this king here, very interested in the spiritual health of one another.
Yeah.
And I don't want to criticize anyone else. Really, just apply myself. How often I have very little thought, and all that's in my mind is how are people doing physically? Like I would say to somebody when I go to work, an unbeliever, how are you? And all I'm really interested in about their physical health. But really, as believers, we should be take account of this verse and think, we really want to ask, how are we doing spiritually? This is what the king wanted to know about these people. And it's a real, almost like a rebuke to me that we have a Gentile king asking of these things, where I very often had very little thought along these lines myself when I've been inquiring of the brethren as to how they are.
Well, I'll give you an example. A few days ago, we went for a meal with some the Lord's people here in Charlotte, and we sat down to the meal, and we'd given thanks for the food, and we'd been served, and we were eating. The question was asked, how did you come to know the Lord? And that question was asked of everyone around the table. Now, obviously, it's a lovely subject, but I haven't really had that experience for a long time, that around the table, brethren have asked a question, a spiritual question of each other, and we've been able to exchange our experiences of the Lord's work in our life. Perhaps it's because we're a little bit private, and we don't want to speak too much about things that are very personal, but in a way, that's a bit sad. When it touches on the Lord's things, we should be willing to speak and exchange thoughts about the Lord, maybe not necessarily relating to us only, but talk about these things freely rather than just talk about the weather or the latest bit of news in the media, or, I've got a new car or something like that. I think it is a good example to us. Obviously, that's bringing things to a very personal level, and this was simply about the remnant as a whole, as a number of people. But definitely the point is taken, Andrew, that he was actually concerned that they were worshipping, they were worshipping according to the law of God in Jerusalem. He wanted that to happen. I think it gives me a sense, and this is another indication that this is really somebody who knew the story of Esther, gives me a sense that he realized that the God of the Jews was indeed God. And because they were in his realm, his empire, it was important that they were flourishing according to the law of their God. But in a way, in principle, that's what it should be, the same for us, because we're members one of another. And it should be of interest and concern to us that we are doing well in the things of the Lord. Because you can't talk about every issue that somebody faces in their lives, because some things are very private. But I think it shows, it is an example to us of the interest we should take in one another, because we are children of God together, and we impinge on one another spiritually. But certainly Artaxerxes had this feeling that these were a very important people. In fact, it's very likely that for many other kings, they were a very unimportant people, because they were at the very extreme end of the empire, or a remote part of the empire, not one that was particularly valued. But certainly Artaxerxes saw that they were important because of their God.
Just going to quote a verse that really justifies what Andrew said. In John's third epistle, he writes, "Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospers."
Yeah.
And so although it's not wrong to require how people's health are, but I think it's more important to see how they are advancing in the things of the Lord.
The king and his counselors had freely offered to the Lord. And the king obviously knew about the fact that offerings to God in Israel could be voluntary offerings, to use the word that Darby uses in verse 16. Besides the voluntary offering of the people and the priests who offer willingly for the house of their God, which is at Jerusalem, he expected not just that Ezra would carry his own offering and the offering of his counselors, but also the offerings that the people in Babylon would also want to give to the temple or the house of God in Jerusalem. So he had a very positive view of what the Jews would want to do towards God, which I suppose has a lesson for us as well, in terms of what we are willing to offer, not just in financial terms, but in spiritual terms, to the service of God. And he wanted in verse 17 that these financial resources that Ezra would take to Jerusalem would be used to buy the various kinds of animals that were used to offer sacrifices to God, bullocks, rams, lambs, and not just the fact that they would be offered up, but their oblations, that's the meal offering, the drink offerings. So this king had quite a knowledge of the Jewish form of worship, I would suggest, from this verse. So he obviously wanted the house of God to be a place where there was vibrant service to God in Jerusalem, not just going through the motions, but real response to God.
So the second thing that is entrusted now to Ezra will be all the free offerings that the king, as well as the counselors, offer.
Mm.
Now, you wouldn't just trust this to anyone. No doubt this was a large amount of money. You don't entrust a large amount of money to somebody unless you got absolute confidence in them. The king had absolute confidence. If he gave this to Ezra, it would get to Jerusalem. It would be offered. And the fact that they offered freely to the God of Israel and acknowledged that his dwelling was at Jerusalem probably supports the idea that this man certainly knew about the God of Israel and probably was a believer. He was offering. This is not, we see elsewhere, others wanted to help in the work. But here, this man is free to give this offering, and it was accepted, no doubt. I would assume this king probably was a believer. He understood this was the place to offer. And it wasn't only the king and the counselors in verse 16. All the silver and gold that he could find in the province of Babylon that others were willing to give, presumably, he was free to take, besides the voluntary offering of the people and the priests who offered willingly for this house. It's all voluntary, freely offered.
Mm.
Whether it's the king or whether it would be others, the Israelites, others in Babylon who wanted to contribute, all that God takes here is freely offered.
Mm.
There's nothing compulsory. God doesn't force anyone to worship. God desires that all those who worship him will worship him of their own will, as it were, freely. This is what God desires. And it's certainly the case here, whether it's the highest person in the kingdom, the king, or whether it's simply one of these people of the captivity. All of them are offering on the same basis. Worship from highest to lowest is always on the same principle. There's no difference. It's freely offered. That's the worship God desires. And God desires we're not compelled to come together and remember the Lord or to worship. If we approach with an attitude, well, we might go through the motions, but God's not going to accept it. When we come, we should come with that motive of love for the Lord, for love for God. That's why we come together. That's why we offer. And if we do that, then God will accept it, because the offerings are free, they're voluntary, they come from a heart that loves. God never compels anybody to worship. And again, this is seen here. It's entrusted. The king says, I want to offer, I'll give it to Ezra. There's a man I can trust to take it and to offer it in the temple. And again, we can say, would someone trust me with such a work?
It is an evidence, again, of the providential blessing of the people by God, even though, as we've heard, he didn't own them as his people in the same way as he had done before the captivity. It's the times of the Gentiles now, and we are still in that time. So we have to bear that in mind. But nevertheless, this king reigned for 41 years. And really, actually, his reign covers effectively the whole period we read about the people being in the land. His reign goes right on to the end of the record of the people being in the land. Obviously, they carried on for hundreds of years after that, the so-called silent years before the Lord Jesus came. But what we get in Ezra and Nehemiah, actually, I think all occurred from this point onwards, all occurred during his reign. So they had the toleration and beneficence of this king, which just reminds me of a verse we have quoted before from 2 Timothy, or from 1 Timothy chapter 2, where the apostle says, I exhort therefore, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, thanksgivings be made for all men, for kings and all that are in dignity, that we may lead a quiet and tranquil life in all piety and gravity. For this is good and acceptable before our Saviour God, who desires that all men should be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So exercise of the king Artaxerxes, and the fact that he could use somebody like Ezra to bring about what he purposed is a practical illustration of what we get in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Of course, it doesn't always happen. We can't always count on our rulers being tolerant of Christians. We know that hasn't always been the case and is not the case today in many a country. But for us, in our countries, we should value it very much, especially as, you know, you get increasing signs that it may be coming to an end. But it shouldn't come to an end because of misbehavior on our part. And certainly it seems that during the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, this king was carrying on his reign. God allowed him to reign for a long time.
It's clear from verse 18 that he had total confidence in Ezra.
Yeah.
Because he says there, whatsoever seemeth good to thee and to thy brethren, do with the rest of the silver and the gold. In other words, you know, Ezra, if you want to go on holiday to Spain, he could have gone.
Yeah.
But as the king realized that Ezra would use that gift for the house of the Lord.
Mm.
And it's good to have that confidence in brethren that when we give them gifts, it is going to be used for the Lord's work.
There's also recognition in verse 17 that there was a need for sacrifices.
Mm.
Because we know that the only way that God could deal in mercy to his creatures is on the basis of the death of Christ. And we're looking forward in this case. And that was an important thing. It's clearly the king thought that these gifts could be used to buy animals for sacrifice. We might think, well, that doesn't seem very good use of money in a financial sense. But understanding that God desired sacrifice, and of course, we know now that those sacrifices look forward to the death of Christ.
Yeah.
It's the only way that God can deal with in mercy with these people.
There is an important principle here in that those who were going back to Jerusalem at this time were not only going to offer for themselves, they were going to offer for those who are still in Babylon.
Mm.
Those people in Babylon, at the start of this letter, the king had said, anyone to go back can go back. But there were some who didn't want to go back, but they wanted to offer still.
Mm.
And God wouldn't refuse those offerings. He accepted them.
Mm.
God honored and respected those brethren, even if they didn't want to go back to Jerusalem. And we've got to ask ourselves, do we honor all the brethren in this way? But those who were going back, they could offer on behalf of those who hadn't. When we come together, we desire to meet on the ground of the one body, which is the scriptural ground in our day. We don't offer for ourselves only and say, well, those elsewhere, they don't offer. We only offer for ourselves here. That's a denial of the one body. We gather on the ground of the one body and we offer on behalf of the one body. And this is what they were doing here. Those going back, they could take these offerings, and when they got back, they would purchase these bullocks and rams and lambs and whatever, and they would offer them there on behalf of those that hadn't gone back. And if we lose sight of this, we become sectarian. It's one of the features of gathering the ground of the one body. We represent the one body, and we offer on behalf of the one body. Anything less, and we're sectarian.
Yeah, later on we're going to see that they did offer on behalf of, very clearly, on behalf of the not just the Jews who were still back in Babylon, but also on behalf of the tribes that were still. Now, in that case, of course, those sacrifices hadn't been provided by the ones that were still captive in the 10 tribes that were still captive in Assyria or wherever they were by this time. Don't know, because we're not told explicitly where they were. And that's one of the reasons why they're sometimes referred to as the lost tribes. But these people had a consciousness that they were part of the earthly people of God, and that was beyond Judah and Benjamin. It included the other tribes as well. I'm sorry, I can't immediately find the verse, but it's definitely later on in Ezra.
The people in Babylon wanted to offer. They wouldn't have given Ezra a bullock or a ram and say, you take it back there and you offer.
No.
They would give them money. And this was the principle laid out in Deuteronomy. If it was too far, you could take his money, you could go to the place where God would place his name, you would convert it back into the offering, what you wanted to offer, and you would do it. And this was the same here. They would give them money, and they trusted Ezra to go back and to use that money to buy these offerings as they'd been instructed and to offer. And Ezra, I'm sure, was honest to do this. In the Lord's day, we have the money changers, the same principle, but they were doing it out of greed for personal gain. And the Lord said, you've made the house of God a den of thieves. But in this day, Ezra was faithful. The same principle there might have been outward, it might look the same. Ezra was faithful, but those people were benefiting from it. And I suppose that's where we get this principle, that if it was too far, you converted it to money, you gave them money, you took it, bought it there, and then you could offer. And this was what was Ezra was doing here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the verse I was thinking of, taking it a little bit beyond that, was Ezra 8:35. The children of those that had been carried away, who had come out of the captivity, presented burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bullocks for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, 12 he-goats for a sin offering, all for a burnt offering to Jehovah.
In every assembly, we have a collection, and we have to have people who, just like Ezra, are trusted to take that money, to count it, to honestly deal with it. Whether we've spoken about giving gifts to workers or the Lord's work, but all stages of that, whether it's from the start where the money is given or transferred, carried somewhere to be passed on, as it was in Paul's day in the early church, it all requires faithful men. We don't give the task of the collection and dealing with it to the man who has got the best maths qualification, the best accountancy degree. We give it to faithful men. It's faith that's required in all things of the Lord's work. And it's something that might seem a very small thing, but if we do it for the Lord, we should honor such people. Those people that are entrusted must be men of integrity, of faith, and must be respected and honored. And certainly Ezra, the features of Ezra are features we should look for those we entrust such an important job to.
Yeah, we get that illustrated, don't we? I probably don't need to refer to it actually explicitly, but it's what Paul writes about in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 in regard to the gift, the carrying of the gift from Corinth and, from Corinth, but it included the gift of the Macedonians in places like Philippi and Thessalonica, no doubt, the gift that was given to Jerusalem that Paul writes about in those chapters, of the people that would accompany the gift, would carry the gift, and it was their faithfulness, their reputation, as well as reputation of being brethren who could be trusted, that Paul writes about in those two chapters in 2 Corinthians.
In verse 19, we have, when it speaks particularly about the vessels, but it says they were to deliver before the God of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It doesn't just say deliver to the people in Jerusalem, right. It says deliver before the God of Jerusalem. So all that they did was to be seen by God, to be under his eye, and to realize their responsibility under God's hand. And of course, that is true for us in all that we do.
And perhaps we could conclude, as we're getting close to the time, with the reference, because I suppose you could divide up the letter here at verse 20, because the king then says, "And I, Artaxerxes, the king, do give orders to all the treasurers." This is the this is the part of the letter which Ezra could show to other people, the people that are mentioned in verse 21, to show that he had the authority of the king, and these people were meant to observe what is written in verse 21. But in verse 20, it says, "And whatever more shall be needful for the house of thy God, which thou shalt have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house." I think that's remarkable in two ways. First of all, the king's confidence in Ezra is indicated here, that he leaves things to Ezra's own judgment. He's prescribed a lot of things that should be done, but at the end of this part of the letter, he says, "Whatever you think, whatever you discover may be needful for the house of your God, that's a matter that you should deal with. You should provide for it." And the second thing that makes it remarkable is that he says, "out of the house, out of the king's treasure house." In other words, not only do I trust your judgment in these matters, but actually, whatever you think needs to be spent, you can spend it from my treasure. So that shows his confidence in Ezra as judgment, but also his readiness to provide whatever was needed too. So this king Artaxerxes, I think he's one of the underrated kings. We often speak about Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus, but perhaps we don't say so much about King Artaxerxes. He is a, I think he does, you would you are almost compelled to think he was truly someone who knew God in his way and was accepted by God. But we can't be dogmatic about that. But he does give real indications in the way he writes of the fact that he trusted God in the way that a Gentile like him might be and should do in those days. He did, and it won't surprise me that he will be in heaven if he's in heaven. Let me put it that way. How often we see a need and we say something about it and then we don't back it up. But here's a king who didn't know that what needs there might be additional to what he's already thought of. He says, Ezra, if you see any, I'll pay for those too. I could learn a little bit from Artaxerxes. Anyway, perhaps we should close the study there. And if a brother would pray, that would be really good.